This program was produced by and first broadcast on Radio Kidnappers, a volunteer-based community access station. For more information, go to www.radiokidnappers.org.nz. Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this program available through funding the Access Internet Radio Project.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, and protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium.
You're listening to Radio Kidnappers, the voice of Hawke's Bay, and I'm Lynn Trafford, presenting, on behalf of the Hawke's Bay branch of the Royal Society of New Zealand, Hawke's Bay Scientists on Air. This program is your opportunity to get to know recently retired and practicing scientists from around the bay. With me in the studio, I have Reverend Dr. Richard Spence, who has been in and around computers since they first came into our everyday lives here in New Zealand. Richard has a background in mathematics and physics and a strong involvement in human communication. A pioneer in computer education, Richard's PhD thesis in that field was a worldwide first. To meet this interesting scientist, we welcome Reverend Dr. Richard Spence to Radio Kidnappers Hawke's Bay Scientists on Air. Hello, Richard.
Hello.
Are you a Hawke's Bay boy, Richard?
I wasn't born here, but my first home was in Hawke's Bay.
Your first home? Did you go to school here?
Yes. Napier Central, Napier Intermediate, and Napier Boys High.
Well, that's almost a Hawke's Bay boy, isn't
almost
it?
Almost a Hawke's Bay
boy. Yes, a Hawke's Bay boy. Was there a defining moment during your mathematics or science at Napier Boys when you thought, I could have a future in this field?
Quite clearly, yes. Nobby Clark was my maths teacher there for the first couple of years. And then after that, it was Mike Rout for 3 years. And between the two of those, they actually gave me a love for the subject, which persists till the present day.
Isn't that nice? I think it's really good when you can actually go right back to a master at school and say the relationship was a good one, and look where we've come today.
Both of them caned me during my period at the school.
Oh, that's all right as well. Yes, that's what happened in those days, I think. We won't ask about that then. After schooling, when you got to the end of your schooling, off you went to university, again to study mathematics. Where did you go?
Went to Victoria and had the good fortune to fall under the guidance of Professor J.T. Campbell, who was a towering figure in mathematics in those days.
So you were there for a bachelor and a master's?
Yes, indeed.
They ran straight in together?
Yes, they did. What
particularly were you studying then for your master's?
Well, I went in the pure mathematics and persevered with modern algebra and related subjects, and was actually one of the country's pioneering topologists.
Ooh, sounds very interesting. Well, that didn't carry on though, did it?
Well, it didn't really need to, only as an interest, because there actually isn't any money to be made out of topology.
Oops, all right. Okay, we won't go down that field then. So we did this these degrees down there at Victoria. What happened after you got your master's? I know you stayed at Victoria University, but was that after the master's or during the master's? What happened, Richard?
Oh, a little bit of an unclear time there. I did teacher training in amongst that period and then returned to Victoria as a junior lecturer in mathematics.
All right. Did that work? Did you enjoy that period of time?
Yeah, somewhat, but one of the things that got to me a bit was that in those days, university was a place that only attracted something like 7% of the population, and my interests are in contacting and interacting with a wider range of people, and so I jacked that in and went to school teaching.
Okay, where did you go off to school teaching?
Colenso High School, Napier.
You came back to the Bay.
Yes.
Came back to the Bay. All right, so now we're in the mid-1960s, and you're back at Colenso High School teaching mathematics, I presume mathematics.
That's what I was hired to do.
Yeah, mathematics.
Yes.
All right then. What else happened during that time?
Well, during that time, having a look at the students and having a look at the curriculum I was supposed to deliver, I thought, some of this is a bit old-fashioned, and what can we do that's a bit more up with the mid-1960s? And one of the things that was up with the mid-1960s was the emergence of computers.
Of course. Or be they rather big and clunky type looking?
They were, yes, they were enormous.
They were, weren't they? We've had a lot of fun. So you stayed teaching there for a wee few years, yeah. And then what happened? You joined the staff of Massey University.
Yes, indeed. There was in those days a department of the university called the Department of University Extension, which I had done a bit of part-time work for, and when a vacancy occurred for a new lecturer in charge of the Hawke's Bay area, I was recruited into that.
Okay, now let's just stop here and sort of get inside what you're actually talking about, because Massey University had this reputation for being a bit of a veterinary, agricultural sort of college, and it's changed into something quite different as we know Massey today, and it's got multiple campuses apart from anything else. So what was an extension university in Hawke's Bay?
Right. The Massey had, by the time I was involved with it, left behind its agricultural roots and was a general-purpose university. It was no longer Massey Agricultural College or Massey University College or a branch of Victoria or any of those things. And one of the things that universities in New Zealand did in those days was to support a Department of University Extension in order to take the benefits of university education into the community, and particularly the adult community of their region.
And this we are talking about at this period of time was before EIT or before...
This was about 3 years before any of EIT's predecessors emerged over the horizon.
That's right, because they were a variety of different names, weren't they?
They went through that.
They did morph somewhat into what they are today. So there you were. What were you teaching, really?
Well, the task was a mixed one. I was supposed to represent mathematics and physics across the Massey region, and at the same time be a local person who managed educational opportunities across the academic field, which involved me in things like music and geology and
okay, so quite general, really.
Well, indeed, my responsibilities were general.
Yeah.
The specialists that I brought in were specialists.
Specific, yeah. Yes. During this time, you did your PhD, did you not?
Yes, I was encouraged to do that.
Right, and now this was considerably groundbreaking. Can we just tell us, just for a minute, what happened during the PhD?
What had motivated me, because I started this research before I ever got into the university, was to try and find out some hard information about the psychology of computer programming. There was a lot talked about this in those days, as people from that era remember, and some quite unqualified persons were trumpeting opinions for which there was no research basis whatever. And I was frustrated by that and got started on some work with youngsters, because those were available to me, and try and discover what are the mental processes that lead to successful computer programs.
Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting period of research for you.
Well, indeed.
Yeah.
And nobody practically was doing any of that, although in the process of the degree I came in into communication with people around the world who were making a start.
Yeah.
And there were sort of a handful of such people.
Yes, interesting times, aren't they?
Ah.
Interesting times for all sorts of reasons. So you stayed in this particular role for about 10 years, and then I find this rather difficult to believe, but you went back to Colenso High School again, did you not?
No, it was a happier environment.
Yes, okay. It was a happy environment in the end. You were teaching the youngsters computer.
Well, by this stage, computer education had become a reality, and so I could actually hold down a position doing that.
And continuing to stay in the Bay, you went to work for Napier City Council.
Yeah.
Computers at this stage being quite well established in institutions such as that, that required a lot of paperwork.
Well, at the time I went, we were pre-PC.
Yes, pre-PC.
And actually introducing PCs became one of my responsibilities.
Oh dear, that would have been exciting for you.
Yeah, I have a number of good anecdotes out of that period.
Oh, I'm sure you have, So you stayed with the Napier City Council for a period of time. Yes. Anything particular happen at that point of time that you wanted to tell us about on this program today?
Oh, well, the big thing was the computerisation of the Napier Public Library. At the time that I joined, they were still doing things on pieces of paper and little cards. Mm. And so forth. And so it was a fascinating project to pick that up and put it onto computer for the first time.
Yeah.
And, there are a number of features of that project were absolutely unique.
Good. We tend to forget that all this had to happen, don't we really?
Yes.
When you think of the PC world or the laptop world of today, you forget that in the time of mainframe, there was an awful lot of data entry that went into putting these systems into a period, into computerisation, really.
Well,
a lot of work.
Just doing the catalogue was 9 months full-time for one librarian.
Yeah, absolutely huge. It was good. And you had the support at that time of David Prebenson, who's a very practical mayor for you to have.
That was the case, yes.
Yeah,
and so when the what is now the current library building was opened, it had a brand new computer system which could issue books and provide a catalogue and things like that.
Mm.
And guess what? It worked right from day one.
Don't we love it when that happens? But that's,
it's so rare. You certainly have to love it.
You do love it, but that is not. It doesn't just happen, does it? It only happens because of all the work that's gone in before going live.
Oh, you bet.
Absolutely. All right. Round about that time, you also did some work on other local government computerisation.
Yes, there were a lot of projects always going on, and my staff were engaged in, at one point, 23 different computerisation projects, all of things that had previously been done with pen and paper.
Interesting, isn't it?
Oh,
great fun.
Cemetery records, dog registration. We could go on and on.
Everything that required an awful lot of paper. Here we were trying to put this into a computer yet again. The 1990s led you to a period of consultancy services around Hawke's Bay, all to do with computer applications. So were there any things of that time that you want to make a comment on before we move past the 1990s?
Well, one thing was that I left Napier City in 1989 because it was clear that the disruption of the reorganisation of local government, which occurred in that year, was going to cause a lot of pain and unnecessary pain at that. And so I decided to quit local government and to and accepted an offer from an outfit called Class Systems Limited, who needed software developers. Class Systems was interesting because it was a Hawke's Bay firm, a subsidiary, in fact, of IMS, but its aim was to provide a centre of excellence in systems development, but Hastings-based.
Yes.
And it did that, and I think we did quite good quality work, but in the end it couldn't survive as a place that far from the big clients, I'm afraid.
Yes, it's a remoteness, isn't it, that today wouldn't happen, maybe, because with everything being online.
Well, I think that's still arguable.
Oh, okay.
I think there's something about the physical presence, which, although it oughtn't to be,
we still like it,
makes
don't we?
A difference.
We do like to still see the chaps and chapsesses walk through the door and to put a face to who it is on the other end of the line with us. We still
or alternatively, when you're feeling frustrated, you can walk in their door and bang on their desk.
Right, okay, the banging on the desk stage. Okay, during the 1990s also, you became ordained as a priest in the Anglican Church.
Yes, that's the case.
That's an interesting tangent to the work with computers, Richard.
No, I don't think so.
No?
No, in fact, it's quite interesting because there's an organisation I belong to called Priests in Secular Employment, which is what I was, and it is quite disproportionately filled with people from the IT industry.
Isn't that interesting? I wonder why.
Well,
do you
I
know
think
why?
It's because we're all in pursuit of reality, and that inevitably leads you to religion.
Okay, all right, and it did you. And started a whole new, well, formalised, I suppose, something that had been of interest to you to actually go through this process to become ordained. It's a big step. I don't think one takes something like that lightly. How did that then sit alongside of the work that continued for you into the 2000s? So if you're ordained in 1995, up comes pretty close after that the year 2K issue.
Yeah, Y2K, yes.
Yes, year 2K. Yeah.
Well, there are a couple of things to say about that, because one of the things was that having been a programmer back in the 70s, I knew that the threat of Y2K was real, because I and others alongside me had produced the code, which was supposed to be short of a couple of digits in the dates, and we knew that it was there. What took us by surprise was that code written in the 1970s was still being used in the late 90s.
I know, what a hoot, yeah.
And if that hadn't been the case, nobody would have had anything to worry about. So that occurred, and Y2K was good for us who were out in the contracting world at that stage, because there were plenty of worried managements around who were putting out good contracts to people who were going to snap them up.
That's right. And it was an interesting time, and yet again, with all that background work that went into it, we rolled over into the new millennium peacefully and easily, but not without all that background work that went into it. That led you to go to Wellington. You left the Bay off, you went to Wellington.
Yes, that's where the work was, and it's this physical presence thing again.
Yeah. All right, so you worked in Parliament for a wee while on the Hansard project.
That was fascinating, because it really rubbed my nose in the processes of democracy and was quite an education. Our particular task was to work in the field of Hansard, the official record of what goes on in the House, and to discover that some of the emerging technologies, well, not just emerging, but established technologies of the time, such as voice recognition and websites and so on and so on, were not in fact available to us for reasons of the way that Parliament does its business.
Yeah.
And anyhow, I spent my bit of time in the House, and it was a great satisfaction to me to be there when the former Anne Hicks, Anne Tolley, Honourable Anne Tolley, gave her maiden speech.
Yes.
Now, why this was a particular satisfaction was that in the days of both of us at Colenso High School, I had been her debating coach.
It's quite funny, isn't it, when we go back and things like that. An awful lot of points of commonality. And with New Zealand being such a small country, we run across this all the time, don't we? I must also now move on to your period of time with Bell Gully and the legal systems that you were working on there. I know we've still got a lot to talk about, and we're going to fast run out of time, I know. So quickly, comment on the time working with the legal eagles.
Well, it was a big legal firm, 450 lawyers, and providing IT services to them was an ongoing challenge. Fortunately, I was only part of the IT department, one of the developers, software developers there. But it did introduce me to the legal world. In a fairly abrupt fashion. Suddenly I was among people who actually care about documents, which isn't normal for IT folk.
No, overly care and tie them up in little ribbons.
Yes.
Yeah. And you enjoyed that time, did you?
Well, it was a unique time, and I was particularly involved with the documents, of course, but programming up self-writing documents so that there were deeds and contracts and so forth, which were driven by logic, And it was my task to put the logic in place.
Yeah, interesting time. Which led on to, you've had such an interesting life, Richard, because we're about to take another leap into something else that I think is really interesting, but completely nothing to do with all this. In the middle of the year 2005, you skived off to India.
Well, didn't skive. I was sent by Rotary International.
Right. Well, yes. There you go. Richard, to anyone that's listening, is also a fellow Rotarian of mine, and you can hear an interview with Richard on Rotary Wheels. But so I know what you were doing.
Yeah.
But can you just explain to the listeners, because it's a fascinating project.
Certainly. One of the things that Rotary International involves itself in is a water project. And its aim is to get water to people who need water.
Yes.
And that's a pretty big aim.
It is.
And Rotary International is part of the international move to try and do that. So a group of three of us were sent over to the Himalayan foothills to assist there with a project, which was to build a retention dam up in a gully so that the farmers downhill from there, subsistent farmers very
yes.
much so, who were growing, horticulture of various sorts, instead of only having 10 growing months in the year, would get 12 because that part of the world has plenty of water while the rain is raining, but there are two dry months. It would give these farmers competitive advantage if they could grow their crops during the two dry months as well as during the 10 wet ones.
Mm-hmm. How many of you went over?
Just
on the
three.
Three.
The way
you, yeah.
that particular project worked was that they would send a team of three each year at the right time of year. And for all I know, they're still doing it.
Still doing it.
Yes.
So the project has been a great success, one hopes?
It depends on how you measure success. And one of the things that we came back with was a far sharper idea of how to give effective help to poor people in foreign countries.
Yes, yeah. Well, in this particular instance, success would be having some water in the two dry months.
Yes, they're growing their crops. Growing their horticulture.
Yeah.
All right, yes.
Yeah, that's, but this had a particular turn on you personally, did it? As far as you came home from India feeling mentally, physically, spiritually refreshed from that time there?
Yeah, I guess. I have to say that I didn't particularly engage in Indian spiritual activities,
no,
although I was fascinated by the fact that so many different religions can actually coexist
yes.
in the same territory, generally peacefully.
You came back and you have this this honour bestowed upon you, which is rather a quaint definition in my mind, a scholar in theology. What is a scholar in theology?
Oh, well, in the ecclesiastical world, there is a sort of educational process that you can go through. And so I reached by doing papers and a thesis, this level of having this scholar in theology degree conferred, which, yeah, I mean, it's one of the things you do and it's helpful.
Good, good. Round about this time also, you started work with the cathedral
yep.
in Napier.
Napier.
Can we have the full name of
it's the Waiapu Cathedral of St. John the Evangelist.
That's right. It's quite a long name.
Well, it reflects two things. One is that it belongs to the Diocese of Waiapu, fascinating organisation all by itself, and it reflects the patronage of St. John, who wrote the Gospel in the
yes.
Bible.
Right. So you started working there, doing some special projects for the cathedral, and round about the same time also, you became the chaplain for the Mission of Seafarers. So can we tie all this together in a little parcel, please, Richard?
Not in any tidy parcel, no.
No, we can't.
No.
Okay, all right. What was happening at the cathedral and what is happening at the Seafarers?
Right. At the cathedral, there, my task was to be available as a community priest, and that title can be defined in a variety of ways. And one piece of that was to get involved with what was going on at the Port of Napier, and I became the chaplain to the Mission to Seafarers in our port. Work that suited well for me because my IT career had taken me into a lot of different industries, and so I was well used to being in somebody else's workplace. And when you do the work, this chaplaincy work on board ship, you certainly are in somebody else's workplace.
You are. What about just a quick summary of what the Seafarers Mission actually is?
What it is. Organisationally, it's a charity that started almost 160 years ago in England, within the Church of England, and provided some home hospitality in the ports of England to those who have to travel between them. It extended eventually around the world, and you will find Mission to Seafarers stations in something like 260 different ports around the world.
And so when the men come into the Port of Napier, how do we look after these people?
Well, in my personal case, I go and pay them a visit. And the other thing is that we have a seafarer's centre here which provides some home comforts, so I direct them towards that as well.
Yes, and the men themselves, are they the same? We have perhaps a notion in our head of what a sailor is, a worker on a ship is. Is that old-fashioned ideal still the same, or have we changed?
Well, we've certainly changed as far as nationality is concerned.
Yes.
Most seafarers these days come from the Philippines and other South Asian countries. And so, you know, the ruddy Englishman with the beard is no longer the seafarer
it's
that arrives in our port.
It's not what we see. No.
Yes.
No.
And the other thing is that ships stay a very short time in our ports now. And so
it's too costly, isn't it?
Well,
I suppose
that's the way the industry is, yes.
Yeah.
And so a ship will easily be in and out of the Port of Napier in 8 hours. And so if we're going to do anything for those people, we've got to be a bit quick about it.
Yes, we do. And I'm sure that they're grateful to have the services of someone such as yourself there to help look after these visitors to the Port of Napier. On behalf of the Hawke's Bay branch of the Royal Society of New Zealand and of Radio Kidnappers, thank you, Reverend Dr. Richard Spence, for being my guest on Hawke's Bay Scientists on Air. To find out more about the role of the Royal Society of New Zealand or the history of data processing in New Zealand or developments of information technology, there are endless sites available to you. A Google search on a quiet day will keep you busy for hours. Do check out the Royal Society. It alone has an interesting history. Please join me again on the second and third Mondays of the month at 9:30 in the morning to meet another practicing or recently retired Hawke's Bay scientist. I'm Lynn Trafford.
This program was produced by and first broadcast on Radio Kidnappers, a volunteer-based community access station. For more information, go to www.radiokidnappers.org.nz. Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this program available through funding the Access Internet Radio Project.